Hello, everybody, and welcome to Science Studio. Today, we're going to continue our conversation with Vance Holliday. He's from the Department of Anthropology and Geosciences at the University of Arizona. And if you remember last week, we were sort of talking in general terms about the role of analysis and looking at stones and the type of rocks or the type of minerals that the arrowheads were made out of to try to learn something about early civilizations, both in the West and also in the Great Plains area. Well, today we'd like to talk again with Vance, but we want to go into some detail about how do you get to a site? When you get there, what do you do? What are you really looking for? Because sometimes you don't know what you're looking for. And we know we also work in Mexico, so we'd like to sort of develop that a little bit. So,
oh, sure.
How do you want to start this?
Yeah, when I moved to the University of Arizona in 2002, I shifted gears in my research from the Great Plains to the southwest and northern Mexico for a variety of reasons. There was a Mexican archaeology student in the department who was working in Sonora, and she was interested in the really early sites, which is what I'm interested in, the so-called Paleo-Indian sites that I talked about before. So I started working with her, and along with this job, the position in Arizona was a private endowment for research on this very topic. And so we started some work in Sonora. She did a lot of survey, going out and looking on the ground or looking at collections from local landowners to find
near Hermosillo or
in the Hermosillo area and north for the most part. We started in the Hermosillo area just because we knew people who collected, and she already knew some archaeologists and knew about some sites. There were several known sites that had produced surface collections, you know, just artifacts on the surface in the Hermosillo area and north towards Nogales. So she started looking at these sites to see if there was anything still intact in the ground, in other words, not exposed at the surface. So surface collections are fine, but if you really want to figure out how old the sites are and find preserved bone, for example, you need to find them buried because the bone and organic material, of course, doesn't preserve very well at the surface. So this one particular site that we ended up excavating was found about 10 years ago. We heard about it. She heard about it. From a local rancher. She and one of my colleagues, my predecessor at the University of Arizona, they were in Mexico looking at some of the little local museums looking for big bones, like from ancient elephants, like mammoth. Because we know that there are actually six Clovis mammoth kill sites in southeastern Arizona. It's the highest concentration.
But did they go farther south?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we knew there were Clovis materials from surface sites in Sonora. And we have these six sites right in the extreme southeastern corner of Arizona. One of them at Naco, Arizona, you can literally see the Mexican border about 200 meters away. So there have to be presumably more sites to the south because there was no border fence 12,000 years ago. And so
certainly no one that would keep
none, out mammoths. None that was preserved. So they were looking for sites because there were Clovis artifacts in surface collections. And they were at one of the museums, and there were some bones of mammoth elephant. And a rancher happened to come by, and he said, oh, yeah, I've got some of those on my ranch. Take that road over there. It'll take you about 3 hours down this ranch road, and you can go to the site. Well, they didn't have 3 hours. And finally, in 2007, she managed to get back out there. And they got to this arroyo, or this old stream cut. And sure enough, there were bones, a big tusk coming out of the ground. And they were there, maybe an hour or less. And they started finding artifacts on the surface, eroded art, including a Clovis point. And so that got everybody excited. I remember I was at my home in San Antonio, and she called me, and it was very exciting, my former home in San Antonio. And so we started excavating, and we excavated for about 3 seasons. It was a little tiny island of sediment. We used to refer to it as a slice of Pleistocene pie, in other words, ancient Ice Age deposits that included these remains of these extinct animals. And we found artifacts on the ground. And so what we were hoping is that in one of these levels that was producing all this bone, we would find artifacts because it could be just paleontological, in other words, just dead animals that had nothing to do with people. And sure enough, there were artifacts associated with one of these levels of bone. And the animal was not the animal that we uncovered. There were two of them. Were not mammoth, which is pretty, you know, most people have seen mammoth in museums, kind of elephant. And it wasn't mastodon, which is the other common elephant. It was a kind of prehistoric elephant called a gomphotheres that is very common in Central and South America at this time period, archaeologically common.
Didn't they have big cats too?
Well, roughly at that time. We've not found the cats. We did find the tooth of an ancient tapir, which is not a North American animal, but that's older. That's not archaeological. It was just a dead tapir in some older deposits. But all these different critters are floating around. There was extinct horse.
There was a zoo there. Did you think so?
Yeah, there you go.
These older people collected animals.
Small animals, maybe.
All right.
So there was quite a variety of now extinct animals in northern Sonora.
Let me ask you this question that always intrigued me, because I noticed reading through some of my archaeological meetings that Keith and I can pay a lot of money and become helpers on some site. Okay.
Right.
So supposing we do that and we go with you, what are you going to tell us to do first? I mean, we're not going to just go there with our shovels. We have to have – how do you teach the students to do it?
Take your sandals off would be the first thing, right? Put on hard shoes. And then after that, thorns. Put a hard hat on, and then we're...
Yeah, you don't need a hard hat out there. thorns and spiky things like we have around here. Well, first of all, you wouldn't have to pay a lot of money to go with them, unless you wanted to. There are those operations.
I know, I've seen them, and they're tempting. They really are.
I've been involved in some of those, but... Be careful is the first thing. Be careful what you're doing.
I could just go and dig where I want, or you tell me to go here? Or?
Yeah, there'll be very specific areas to dig, because we were excavating where we saw the bones eroding out. There was no point. Well, at that point, our main effort was to get to this bone bed, because there was quite a bit of erosion, and we wanted to get what we could, because we'd lost most of the site. We knew that. We had this little slice of Pleistocene pie, as I called it. Most of the site was gone, long since eroded away, and so we wanted to get what was left. And so we knew where the bones, you could see the bone coming out in these exposures. And so that's where we were digging. And we set up a grid, a 1 meter by 1 meter grid system across the site. And so you dig within your assigned
Thing you do is map it and assign it grids, and you say you work in square this and you work in square that.
That's exactly right. That's how it works.
So then if I find something sticking out, do I pull it or I
No, leave it in the ground.
Know.
Yeah, very carefully. We use mason's trowels, like you can buy at a hardware store, and very carefully trowel through the sediment, slowly, carefully dig through the sediment. We screen all the sediment, put it through window screen to see if we're missing small flakes or something, and map everything that seems to be of importance. For example, if it looks like an artifact, a broken projectile point, if you're lucky, or a tool, stone tool, something that's very different from the surrounding sediments, bone fragments, lots of bone fragments in this site. And then when you get down to the actual level where our bone bed was, of course, then you have to very carefully uncover the bone. The bone was in terrible shape, so we had to use a lot of preservative on the bone. In a lot of cases, we would encase the bone in some kind of, in the old days, they used to use plaster of Paris. One of the things we've used is this foam insulation you can buy for your house. You can buy big quantities of this stuff, and we put foam around these bones. Then they get taken back to the lab and excavated very carefully under laboratory
conditions.
And so
I know that one of the things I've been reading recently is that DNA analysis is really coming along. Mm-hmm. Is there any possibility DNA still survives if the bone is deep enough?
Sure, it's possible. I was just having a conversation with somebody about this the other day. One of the things we found in the site was an entire mandible jawbone of one of these gomphotheres, one of these elephants that's rare in North America. And if we're really lucky, we might be able to get DNA out of the teeth. But it just depends on the weathering of the bone and the teeth. There's very little data right now on DNA from these ancient animals, but it's something that people are starting to work on. A lot of the focus of DNA research, certainly in archaeology, has been on human remains, but we don't have that. So we're going to try to do some DNA work on our elephant jaw, but we don't have a lot to compare with because there hasn't been a lot of work done on that. But, yes, we definitely like to see if we can recover the DNA. We don't know if it's preserved. But we'll find out.
One of the issues about working in an international program is that I know in Mexico in particular, it's not so easy to take samples back out of Mexico.
Right.
I mean, this is part of their heritage, and so the samples I mean, in the old days, obviously, you just go down and take it. But now I think we've evolved to the point where you go through the proper channels. But is it still difficult to get a sample and then bring it back for analysis?
Yes. But one thing, I'm glad you brought that up. One thing I should emphasize is that this project is a joint project between the University of Arizona and INAH, the Instituto Nacional de Antropología y Historia. We're working with the office out of Hermosillo. My former student is now an archaeologist with INAH, and so it's a joint project, and I want to make that clear.
No, I had an experience. Yeah. We had samples from Mayan paintings from INAH that we had to give each one back. And
oh, yeah. No, we don't take anything out. So the Mexican archaeologists in Hermosillo are working on this, and then they have a paleontologist working with them in Mexico City. So they'll do all that sampling.
So they'll do the DNA analysis.
I think the DNA analysis will go probably out of the country because there are very few places that are doing this sort of DNA analysis anywhere in the world. So I don't think we're going to have that option of not sending it out. But they handle that. And it's all done with permits, archaeological permits and sample permits that I have to deal with as well. But as I said, it's a cooperative joint project. Right. And so they handle all of that, and it makes it easier.
So Keith and I are finished for the day.
Okay.
Are you going to pat him down and see what he's got in his pockets?
If he has any artifacts.
Do you worry about that? I mean,
I've never been in a situation where we thought that was a problem. I mean, mostly you always know the people, particularly if they're your students. You're going to know.
Right. There are degrees on the line, right?
Right.
Tell me, you know, nowadays you have satellite imaging all over the place. People are using it for discovering minerals, for looking at harvesting times and all the rest of it. Can it be used ab initio, if you like, to look for interesting sites to go and do excavations?
Oh, yeah. That's been around actually for decades with air photography, satellite imagery. And now, of course, there's so much more. You can go on Google.
Pretty much trails and the way paths and...
The problem with that is you never know if they're historic or prehistoric. For example, just a few weeks ago, I was looking at a site in northern Sonora near the town of Trincheras, and it was an early agriculture site. And you could see on Google Earth what are most certainly canals from agriculture about 4,000 years ago. Well, not quite that old, maybe 2,000.
So,
Google.
You saw it from Google, and then you went to the ground to justify
it. It was the other way around. We had been at the site, and we knew there were canals. You could see them buried, and we knew there was some exposed on the surface. And so I went back to Google Earth, and we realized, holy cow, they're all over the place.
So hang on, how do you know it's a canal? I mean, is it constructed so you can see walls of... I don't know what. How do you know it's a canal?
In a lot of places,
as opposed to an arroyo.
Oh, in a lot of places where they're not using rock, you can still tell because first of all, you can map them out if you excavate them horizontally, and they'll be nice and straight. I was looking at some in Tucson last year. They're made little fields about the size of your studio here, little rectilinear fields, and you expose
a field
them,
the size of our studio.
But dozens of these things surrounded by little channels.
Where specifically are we talking about now?
The little rectilinear fields I was looking at are right in Tucson. Site I'm talking about in Mexico is there, this little village of Trincheras. There, they're not rectilinear fields, but you see these long, straight channels that were excavated. The sediment that's filling them has charcoal and bone and shell. And down there in Sonora, they actually lined them with rock. They lined the channels with rock. And you could trace them for hundreds of feet. And they're straight, and they go right to the river, which is where they're diverting water. They're parallel, very regular. That's the thing. They're very, very regular.
Okay.
And a natural arroyo, a natural channel, won't be that regular.
And this is going back how many thousands
of
years?
Oh, I think this site is about 2,000 years old, an early agriculture site. And so there, you could use air photography, satellite imagery to help you map or even find sites once you know what to look for. Our site in Sonora, this farther south, this Gomphuthir site, you'd never be able to find it on imagery because there's nothing to see from above. You have to be on the ground. Now, there are lake deposits where these bones are coming out, and those show up very distinctively. So one of the things we want to do is see if we could spot other places that look the same on Google or whatever satellite imagery we have. If they look the same, we don't know that they are the same, but if they look the same, and then go and see what they look like on the ground, and if they're, say, ancient lake deposits, then we can start poking around, seeing if there's bone coming out, look for artifacts. So it can help. Remote sensing like that is very useful.
You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Vance Holliday from the University of Arizona, Department of Anthropology and Geosciences. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neeson. Ancient Egypt is among the most studied ancient societies, so it can seem as if there's not much more to discover.
Yet archaeologists continue to prove us wrong. Just a year ago, they unearthed a dynasty that historians had only speculated existed.
They found a mummy of a pharaoh from the Abydos dynasty during Egypt's second intermediate period from 1640 to 1550 BCE. The tomb is south of Cairo, containing a 16-ton sarcophagus made of red quartzite.
What's interesting is the sarcophagus was taken from a tomb of an earlier dynasty. This and other reuse of materials in the tomb suggest the Abydos dynasty had limited resources and faced pressures from the two larger kingdoms, the Thebes dynasty to the north and the Hyksos dynasty to the south.
The mummy turns out to be Pharaoh Sinubke, and a forensic analysis revealed a surprising detail. The muscle attachments in his femur suggest years spent on a horse. Another king's body discovered nearby also shows evidence of horse riding.
Using horses in combat wasn't popular until much later, so this tells us Egyptians of this period were mastering something quite new. Scientists theorize Sinubke was mounted on horseback when he was killed in battle.
His skeleton revealed 18 wounds that penetrated the bone. He was most likely on his horse when attackers slashed at his feet, legs, and back. When he was down, they killed him with axe blows to the head.
The Abydos dynasty was short-lived during a time when Egypt's central authority collapsed, dividing the nation into many smaller kingdoms. No doubt we'll hear more about it. Descriptions from Sinubke's tomb have led archaeologists to at least seven other tombs.
We are Drs. David Neeson and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discovery shaped the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Vance Holliday from the Departments of Anthropology and Geosciences at the University of Arizona. And we're talking about all sorts of things. We're talking about how do you work on these sites. Mm-hmm. So let's continue that. Russ, you had a point you'd like to ask.
Yeah, from historically speaking, you have the Tarahumara Indians there, which I think there are 2 million of them or something like that, that do not speak Spanish. And historically also, you're working in Sonora. The history says that the Aztecs were coming from the north, somewhere around there. You know, originally, before they got to Lake Texcoco, they were coming out. So I'm just wondering if we know anything with the DNA about the Tarahumara, and how did they get there, or the people from the north?
No, we don't. The people who are there now and probably in late prehistoric times are the Seri Indians, S-E-R-I. Tarahumara are, I believe, to the south and east of us. I don't know anything about the early Aztecans. I think that the Aztec civilization as we know it started south. The people themselves genetically may have come from the north, but there's evidence of connections in southern Arizona and northern Sonora with the Aztecs, but not any.
Well, what are those?
Like feathers of parrots.
All right.
Trading feathers, yeah, and other art
coming
objects.
Coming out of Casas Grandes.
Yes,
we
exactly.
We know they were trading north.
Right.
That's
just
not too far. In fact, we talked to Mike Whalen, who is one of the big experts on Casas Grandes. I mean, and that was one of the first places that they discovered with central heating, effectively, mm-hmm, but it was for the birds, not for the people.
Right. And there's some sites, I think, in southern Arizona that have the birds, or at least bird images. Yeah. But so they're coming from the south, going north, presumably from trade, and other art objects of one kind or another. But that's an area of archaeology that I have little
experience. It's interesting. I remember that because when the Aztecs arrived, Teotihuacan was already abandoned, you know, previously.
Right.
And they were coming, things are reading, coming from what they thought the north was. But I don't think we really know where they came from. But now this genetic material, I think, is going to clear up a lot of that.
What you have to do is find genetic material in prehistoric populations. A lot of the work so far has been on modern populations, and that's very informative and useful. But, for example, to understand where the Clovis people, for example, came from, you'd have to find genetic material preserved from that time period, which is exceedingly rare. And you'd have to find the remains of prehistoric populations in Asia, and their genetic material. So it actually gets to be fairly complicated to know what was going on in the past genetically.
But not impossible.
But no, absolutely not. No, not impossible. Now, right now, you mentioned this controversial find from a few years ago that we were talking about, the so-called Caucasoid, and that was Kennewick, from Kennewick, Wisconsin. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There are at most a couple of dozen human remains from all of North America of that age in various states of preservation. So there's very little DNA from that time period preserved in North American prehistoric populations. So we have a ways to go, but it's certainly not at all impossible.
The other thing I remember about that, too, was that particular area was under the control of a Native American tribe, and there was all kinds of rules.
Yes.
And there were some graduate students who were trying to graduate in Santa Barbara or someplace like that, had written their thesis. And for a while, the thesis were closed by the courts because the information came from there.
I haven't heard about the problem with the theses.
Well, eventually they let them go,
yes,
but they had a delay of a couple of years.
Oh, yeah.
Courts.
Yeah, that was quite a legal hassle because there's some laws having to do with.
Well, I think I remember the law was that if this Native American area, they were ancestors, mm-hmm, you couldn't take anything off. But then they argued that this particular case was much older than any of the ancestors that were there, which was the winning argument.
Right, that there was not – you couldn't make a direct connection between the people who are there now and these remains that are 10,000 years old. That there was no obvious direct connection because we know that a lot of these populations moved around historically and almost certainly prehistorically.
Your comment there about theses and, you know, brings it up to mind that you use students. You know, the students are an integral part of your research. You also mentioned that expression the other week about archaeological clearance. And it seems to me that I know here on Fort Bliss, when the military wanted to expand, that one of the first things they had to do before they could use any of the land was to go in with archaeologists to do this sort of clearance and study to learn things. That means to me, I mean, I may be wrong, that's a relatively new concept.
Right.
I think 30 years ago, maybe 50 years ago, that wasn't an issue. If the military or the federal government or anybody wanted to use land, they'd just go and use it. So there must have been a big upsurge in the number of people needed. And therefore, talk a little bit about career opportunities for students going into this area of, well, what do you call the area? It's just not anthropology, it's geosciences, it's... What's a good preparation for people, and are there good opportunities still?
There's certainly more now. I was started out in archaeology just as this was taking off in the early 70s. Now, there had been earlier efforts, salvage archaeology it used to be called, like on the Great Plains when they built all these reservoirs in the 30s and particularly in the 50s, these lakes on rivers. There was a lot of archaeological work associated with that. But it wasn't legally mandated in quite the same way, and that all changed in the early 70s. So any public funding or licensing, not just federal, if that any sort of licensing was involved or funding, then there had to be environmental impact research, not just archaeology. Archaeology is probably best known, biological, historical as well. But there's private companies now. When I started out, there were no private companies doing archaeology. It was all through universities. But now most of this work is done through private companies. Some of them are multi-million dollar operations. They hire students, not just students and professionals, PhDs for that matter, in anthropology, PhDs in geology, and some of the bigger companies. And so there's a lot of work.
It's a direct question to me because I had a son that came here to study archaeology, mm-hmm, master's degree. And after a while, he said, you know, I don't think I can make any money in this field. I'm going to be an engineer. And he got a degree in engineering and is doing well. But I think that for students thinking about it, it's something that you really got to say, you know, you really have to love this and take your chances.
That's exactly right. You're not going to be rich. Of course, there are no guarantees in any profession, I guess. And I think there are probably more people interested in archaeology than there are jobs. I mean, it's just a fundamental truth that you have to realize. But there are jobs out there. Just as an example, I have a PhD student. She first got her master's degree in geology in the early 90s and went to work doing this kind of archaeology. It's cultural resource management, CRM archaeology. She, as a geologist, had a very successful career for about 15 years doing this kind of work all over the Southwest. And she decided she wanted a PhD, and so she's back in geosciences working with me, but also working on an archaeological research for a PhD. But she's had a very successful career, partly in her case because there weren't that many people trained in geoarchaeology, as we call it. And she was, and she liked doing that kind of work as opposed to a regular research PhD kind of things that I do.
So and what other opportunities? I mean, how many people have been graduated from these sorts of programs?
Oh, gosh.
And then so the idea is, do they go into other professions, right, banking, and simply because they've got some analytical skills?
Right.
It's not just simply doing the job that they do.
The students who get undergraduate degrees often can get work like in the summer, shovel bums, as we used to call them, digging. But not even that many. It's a pretty small percentage at the undergraduate level. At the master's level, the likelihood of employment with some of these companies is more. In fact, we just started just this year a master's degree program in what we call applied archaeology. And it's actually intended for people who are already in the business and who want to get more training, come back. Maybe they have a bachelor's degree and have been digging holes for 5 years.
All right.
And they want to go on, and they come back, and we have a program specifically focused on that. But you can go on to the PhD level. In fact, I suspect, I don't know the numbers, to be honest, but my guess is that there are probably more PhD archaeologists employed in the private world than in research. I mean, there just aren't that many academic positions, and they're fewer now, given economic
situations. But going back to the undergraduates,
right,
if they don't go on to graduate school, what do they do?
You name it. I've known a lot of undergraduates that have ended up in the business world, maybe other aspects of environmental studies.
Right. So it's a sounding board. I mean, they can jump off into many
right,
directions. So it's not an issue that you worry about attracting people into, as you say, it's a tremendous interest, but you don't always know what outcomes that they can access.
We always have more students applying than we can accept, particularly at Arizona. It's a very well-known program. And right now we're dealing with graduate admissions, but there are so many more students applying than we can handle. Well, that's at the graduate level. But the undergrads, there are lots of them interested in archaeology. But it always surprises me how few of them are even interested in going on. They're in college and they take archaeology courses because they're interested. But a surprisingly small number are actually even thinking about going on to become archaeologists.
And I don't know why. They're not in the majors program.
No, even the majors aren't necessarily thinking about becoming professional archaeologists. It's a pretty small proportion.
I have a question that's intriguing me. We were talking about the Tigris and Euphrates before, mm-hmm, right?
Right.
And, of course, we know that Abraham started there and moved toward the Promised Land. And I was reading an article where they were caulking their boats with petroleum that was leaking, mm-hmm, there. And maybe they salted their farms there, and that's why they had to leave and go north.
That's possible. I know that in the archaeological record, my recollection is that there's some evidence of those kinds of problems. The other part of it, though, down there on these floodplains, they're constantly getting, like in the Nile, for example, they're constantly getting flooded and new sediment deposited. So in situations like that, you might have a little bit better chance.
So that's enriching, yeah.
It's enriching, and you're not using exactly the same landscape over and over and over. Like, once you get away from the floodplains, like around here, you get away from the Rio Grande or the Pecos, you're on old landscapes that aren't flooded. And that's when you have this problem of salinization. And that's a geologic issue.
Well, it's a geologic issue, anthropological issue. It's your career.
Right.
It's our enjoyment to listen to you, Vance. And so thank you very much for being
here. Oh, sure. It's fun to be here. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And maybe there's entrepreneurial enterprises here where you can get guys like Keith and I to pay a lot of money to go down there and dig.
Yeah.
I would love to do that. Thanks to Vance Holliday from the University of Arizona. Thanks for being here in Science Studio. Please come back. Very fascinating topic. And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And thank you again for listening. I don't think I'm coming with you, Russell. I'm going to go to play golf somewhere instead.
Really?
Hey, thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.